The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This was a counterintelligence investigation, which miraculously morphed under Mueller into a criminal investigation. A criminal investigation of what? It's a fundamental aspect of our law that you have to have probable cause. You have to say, before you have an investigation of somebody, you have to say, what is the crime that we believe has been committed that we are investigating? And that's important for anyone, for any American citizen, but it's especially important in matters related to the presidency and elections.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 13th, 2018. Back in January, I sat down with my friend Mike Duran, a foreign policy and Middle East specialist who served in the George W. Bush White House, State Department, and Pentagon, and is a former Brookings colleague, to discuss his, surprising to all of his friends, support of President Trump and dismissal of the Trump-Russia allegations and investigation of L'Affaire Russe. At the end of that conversation, we said we'd check in again in a few months and see whose views history had treated more kindly, his or mine. Earlier this week, that period elapsed, and we sat down over scotch to talk through Duran's views of, among other things, the Mueller investigation, Rod Rosenstein, Jeff Sessions, the Steele dossier, Carter Page's FISA warrant, and the congressional investigations into the affair. It's safe to say that our views have not converged, and Duran's view of the world differs from the standard fare on Lawfare, too. Hang on to your hats, folks. This one's a wild ride. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 355, Through the Looking Glass with Mike Duran. An update. Let's start with the question of whether we have converged in our views or diverged further since the last time we chatted, which was, I think, like early in the year. My impression from your Twitter feed is that you have radicalized, which I suspect you think the same of me. But where are you now relative to where you were when we had our lengthy conversation the last time?
Well, I don't know that I radicalized, but I feel that I'm pretty much in exactly the same place, but more so. And that there was a lot I didn't know the last time, a lot of questions I didn't have answers to. And now I feel like I have answers, so I'm pretty certain that I was totally correct and you were totally wrong.
All right, so walk me through that. What are the views that you have that have been reinforced by the subsequent information that you've received and the passage of time?
I'm convinced that senior levels of the Justice Administration and the FBI participated in an effort to discredit the Trump campaign by launching a bogus investigation into Russian collusion and then leaking the fact of that investigation to the press.
All right. So you are aware, when you say that, of the counter narrative that, you know, crazy people like me believe, you know, that this was a counterintelligence investigation sparked by information from a allied foreign intelligence service about George Papadopoulos, that there is nothing especially unusual about the Carter Page FISA or the use of material that came from where it came from in it. Why do you look at this same fact pattern that I do and see an outrageous political conspiracy on the part of the Justice Department and the FBI to politically spy on and discredit the Trump campaign.
Do I infer from your question that you don't concede my point? So I thought we were going to sit down here and you were going to tell me that you totally agreed with me.
So I was going to concede error on all points, but then I had my first sip of scotch and I'm feeling a little bit more combative. So I just want to, before I concede error, I just want to make you justify it a little bit.
Oh, okay. All right. I still
so
we have to go through this exercise.
Yeah, I'm just making you do the work. Then at the end, I'll concede that you're right about everything.
Oh, Mike. Good. Okay. As long as those are the terms of the discussion. I would put it to you. When we spoke last, I was focused, I think, I can't really remember, on the Carter Page business and the dossier, mm-hmm. which I still think the dossier is central to everything. But about a week after we spoke, or 2 weeks, I don't remember, the New York Times did that long piece on Papadopoulos. On my Twitter feed, a lot of your followers tweeted at me and said, aha, this proves that you're totally wrong, the Papadopoulos business. And I, of course, had the exact opposite reaction. So you're telling me that they opened, let me just get your understanding of how this thing began, that they opened up this investigation because of Papadopoulos' conversation with Mifsud. Is that how you understand it?
Well, I think the immediate cause was Papadopoulos' conversations with an Australian diplomat in which he described Mifsud's telling him that the Russians had a whole lot of Hillary Clinton's emails.
Okay, so we've got a 28-year-old staffer who has no significant relationship with the Trump administration, who has a boozy conversation with George Downer in London and mentions something about this. And this opens up a whole investigation of the Trump-Russia collusion. That pillar, supposed pillar of the investigation, it doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
So let me throw that back at you. Your contention is that when the FBI represented to the FISA court and to a lot of other entities, including the House Intelligence Committee, that was the source of the investigation. And when Comey testified in March of 2017 that the investigation had been opened in the summer of 2016, that was all lies.
Gross misrepresentation, I would say. I mean, this is the equivalent. We've all seen the detective stories where there's the guy that the authorities want to get, and they put the bag of cocaine in his drawer or in his glove compartment in order to open the investigation.
And so why do you believe that? I mean, I look at this and I say, first of all, George Papadopoulos's relationship with the Trump campaign was not trivial. It was significant enough, although he was an outside advisor. It was significant enough that he has pled to and Mueller has alleged, and the court has accepted his plea, that was the reason that Mifsud was interested in him. And, you know, yes, he was 28, but, you know, foreign intelligence services and their cutouts do try to go through people that they can get to.
Oh,
and
sure.
So you have this
All
guy wandering around
time.
Europe, hanging out, making deals, making representations, boasting of his relationship with the Trump campaign, and people glom onto him. What's implausible about that? And what's implausible about the fact that would be of interest to the FBI?
If it was just there, if it was just that, nothing implausible at all. It's what they did with it that is, first of all, this is not an unusual thing that happens, right? Wait, let's take a step back. Do we even know that Mifsud is working for the Russians?
Well, we know that the government has alleged that he is.
Where do we know that he alleged that?
We know that the government has alleged in the Papadopoulos papers that he was, you know, had ties to.
My reading of that is a little different.
Okay,
I don't have the text in front of me, and and it's not a big deal, but let me just say that my reading of that is different. I think a close reading of what Mueller has released on the plea deal with Papadopoulos is that Papadopoulos believed that Mifsud had connections, and Mifsud may well have presented himself as that, as a representative of the Russians. There's no conclusive statement that Mifsud was a representative of Putin. I think that's important for a lot of reasons.
Okay.
But so already we're in this gray area. I mean, all that Papadopoulos has pled guilty to is making a false statement to the FBI. So to me, already that's amazing, right? That we've had 2 years of a Trump-Russia investigation, massive leaks to the press, painting the Trump campaign and then the early administration as somehow beholden to Putin. And there's absolutely no indictment that's come out of this investigation that proves any of that at all, even comes close to proving that. But that's point one. Point two is that this kind of thing happens all the time. Spies are Russian spies, foreign spies, Chinese spies, who knows, Iranian spies. They're all over Washington, D.C., and they're making contact with Americans, witting and unwitting Americans all the time. And the FBI knows that. And the FBI has in its – this isn't new for them. It's not an unusual circumstance. They have in their repertoire all kinds of ways to deal with this. And they don't immediately open up a full-blown investigation and assume that Papadopoulos is somehow representing the campaign in a criminal activity.
So when you say it is all about the Steele dossier arises later, and this file is already open at that point. Mm. Carter Page is, by the time of the FISA request, no longer associated with the campaign. Are you of the view that it was inappropriate, given everything they knew, to open a FISA against Carter Page?
Yeah, totally. But before we get to Carter Page, can I just say something about Papadopoulos?
Yeah, sure.
Or just something from my own personal experience? I worked in the White House, in the George W. Bush administration. And I had this experience one time where the counter-intel people saw that I worked on the Middle East. I don't know if I said that. And the counter-intel people saw that an agent of a hostile power in my area of responsibility was gaining regular access to the White House, because there was a person working in the White House who had a dual national from this nefarious country. And the foreign agent had struck up a friendship with the dual national, who was regularly meeting with the foreign agent, who may or may not have actually gotten into the White House. I'm not sure about that bit. The FBI made the assessment that the dual national who was working in the White House was unwitting of the intentions of the agent. But they had an investigation. But this is not a criminal investigation. It's a counterintelligence investigation. And I asked through the proper channels to unmask the name of the dual national working in the White House who was friends with the agent. And I did that out of concern that I may, in the course of my work, be talking to this person. And I wanted to make sure that I didn't say anything that I wouldn't say publicly, because I didn't want to, unwittingly transmit usable information to this agent. Think about that for a second. I could destroy that person's life, the person working in the White House. I now had information that person was a close friend of a foreign agent. Had I leaked that to the newspaper or gone telling other people about it, of course, I would have broken the law if I had done that. But I could have destroyed that person. It's enormous power. It has to be wielded very carefully. And the FBI comes into contact with these problems all the time, and they have a number of ways of dealing with it. And one of the ways was that they dealt with it in this case was to alert coworkers that this was going on, or people in sensitive positions that this was going on, and to watch it. They could alert the person if they trusted them, they could alert the person's employer and ask just to have them moved out of any sensitive areas or anything like that. So in both with regard to Carter Page and with regard to Papadopoulos, there were these things that the FBI could have done. They could have called in. They didn't interview Papadopoulos until January. They could have interviewed him. They could have called him in and said, "Hey, this guy, we think this guy's bad news." They interviewed Mifsud, right? They had a long relationship, we now know, with Carter Page. Carter Page had cooperated with them several years before in another counterintelligence investigation. They didn't call in Carter Page to interview him. So question number one for me is, why did they decide not to do all these normal things that they do? When you got a 28-year-old, clearly not, however important you think he is in the campaign, I think he's minor for all kinds of reasons, but let's not argue that. He's not major. He's not sitting there on Trump's shoulder whispering in Trump's ear. He's not a trusted envoy of Donald Trump. Doesn't have a long relationship with him. It's not somebody that Donald Trump is going to use for relations with Vladimir Putin. Same thing with Carter Page. Carter Page doesn't even know Donald Trump. So what was it that made the FBI decide that we won't use these usual tools that we have in these circumstances? Instead, we'll open up a full-blown investigation based, we now know, on the assumption that there's something really nefarious going on. And okay. That's the dossier.
So I want to submit that that's not the dossier. And I want to give you an alternative hypothesis for why George Papadopoulos looks very concerning in that moment to the Bureau. And that is that the DNC had been hacked. The Clinton emails had been hacked. It probably is atmospherically not irrelevant that the candidate himself is calling on the Russians to release the information. But let's leave that aside for a moment. But I think in an environment in which the sequence of events are you have evidence of the penetrations, you have evidence of the theft, the information is starting to be released, and with all of that going on as background, you have someone that the Bureau clearly believed was, what, rightly or wrongly, clearly believed was a cutout for the Russians, approaching a person associated with the Trump campaign, however distantly, and in advance of that, offering a trove of Hillary Clinton's emails, all of which, I think when you put it together, summer of 2017, before you get into the dossier period, before Carter Page, that's an alarming fact pattern, no?
No, no. Because Papadopoulos didn't even say, according to Downer, Papadopoulos didn't even say emails. He said dirt or something of that kind. So it's only in retrospect that you go back and you put this whole picture together and see it as them focused in clearly on that. Look, if they thought that Papadopoulos was talking to Russians about emails, that may well have been on their mind. Like I say, why not call them in? Why not come down on them hard? Why not come down on them really hard?
So one of
then why wait until whenever Mueller came down on him really hard? When was that? I can't even remember when he. So January was it?
Would have October of last year.
Was it October?
I mean, he wasn't first. He was first interviewed in January of 2017. I think he's.
When do they stick the screws to him, though? Really, it would have been.
I think it was July of 17. So it's a year later.
So, come on.
Here's my question. There's a lot of other things that have happened in the intervening months. Manafort's trial and then guilty plea, the Michael Cohen flip, which is not immediately related to this stuff, but is there's the Maria Butina stuff. There is the spinoff investigations that Mueller has kicked to the Southern District of New York involving a number of lobbyists, including, interestingly, a number of Democratic lobbyists. And there is the hacking indictment. And so when I look at that larger body of work, a big part of me says, why is Mike Duran and Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy and Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan, why are these guys, I notice how I've elevated you to the level of members of Congress here. Why are these guys still focused on the origins of the investigation rather than being focused on the substance of what the investigation has yielded? I mean, it's almost as though you're arguing and the whole crowd of you is arguing, if we can just establish that this whole thing has its roots in a dirty dossier, as the president says, then the investigation will be discredited and goes away. But I look at the investigation and says, at this point, the investigation stands or falls on the quality of the prosecutions and indictments that it's brought.
Oh, no.
And, you know, at what point do you have an obligation to look at the picture that the investigation has painted rather than the picture that your crowd has painted of it?
Let the record show that I'm so animated.
That you're pouring more scotch.
So disturbed by your statements that I had to pour more scotch. First of all, you paint them as my crowd, and
By association I'm engaged with.
No. I'm going to make a distinction. I'm a Devin Nunes fan. I'm not a Trey Gowdy. Trey Gowdy's a squish, as far as I'm concerned.
I see.
for the record.
How about Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows?
I haven't followed Jim Jordan. I'm probably in lockstep with Amisumi, but because the problem for me, actually, I don't even know that Nunes has said this. The problem for me with Trey Gowdy is that he says he's in that crowd that's saying, at least last time I noticed, let Mueller finish his work, and I think the Mueller investigation is completely corrupt. Which is not to say that Mueller himself is corrupt, but the investigation is based on totally false pretenses.
Okay, there's a lot of layers to this. Let's unpack them one by one.
So let me, if I'm just to answer you, if I just go boom, boom, boom and answer your question simply, I do believe that the investigation during the camp, this thing has three stages to it. Stage one is up until the election. And it's not the same thing. It morphs at each point. Stage one is during the election. Stage two is during the transition. And then stage three is the Mueller probe. The Mueller probe is the direct outgrowth of what started during the campaign. And what started during the campaign was corrupt and was based on the dossier. And you can see that clearly when you look at the Carter Page FISA warrant. That's based on the that is basically based on the dossier. So there's that bit. I do believe that it begins with the dossier, and I do believe that the Mueller probe is corrupt because it is the direct outgrowth of that earlier investigation. And it is not what I thought it would be when it was first stood up, which would be a kind of dispassionate investigation of all of the issues around Russia and the election. Because for me, the elephant in the room is that one party, the Democratic Party, the Hillary Clinton, paid for a dossier which contains information that came directly from Russian intelligence sources. And that was the basis for an investigation and for leaks during the campaign designed to present the Trump campaign as in Putin's pocket. That has to be under, if you're an observer from Mars and you're going to say, I'm going to investigate all the universe of issues surrounding Russia and the campaign, you would have to say, I'm going to investigate the possibility that the dossier itself was a tool of Russian influence over the campaign.
Okay. So
we got to get to the Mueller probe.
We're at layer number one now.
Yeah, you had all these
like ogres.
All these indictments. Every time I argue with somebody about this, we get to the Mueller, and then what about all the indictments? Yeah, and the indictments are.
We're gonna get.
We got to get to that.
But I want to focus on this because it seems to me that people like you who are making this argument are missing a big thing, and that's that the FISA court has a lot of judges on it. I think 11 judges on the FISA court. Bunch of them heard these things. And by the way, all of them are perfectly capable of reading Devin Nunes's speeches on the subject or your articles on the subject. Some of them may even follow you on Twitter. They are very aware, if to whatever extent they want to be, of everything you're saying. And not one of them, to my knowledge, has asked for supplemental briefing from the government about the way this case was handled. Not one of them has raised a question about whether there was what you're describing as a fraud on the court. All of them have access to the same information that you do and a great deal more. And none of them have turned around and say, wait a minute, I have a problem with the quality of the information that the FBI represented to us and the Justice Department. The FBI swore to and the Justice Department, who are officers of our court, represented to us. And I am interested in your sense of whether the court here is part of the corruption or whether the court is a kind of hear no evil, hands over the eyes, or whether they're dupes. Like, why? The FISA court is there for exactly this purpose. Everything that Devin Nunes has said is available to the FISA court. Why are they so untroubled by this?
No idea. I have no idea, and I don't even want to speculate. Actually, I do want to speculate, but I'll restrain myself. I don't know who these people are.
They're all appointed to the court by Chief Justice John Roberts.
But I have read.
Who, granted, from your point of view, is a squish. But
actually, I have no strong feelings about Justice Roberts. But I've seen the redacted FISA warrant, and it's a joke. So
has it ever occurred to you the possibility that that may be what a FISA warrant looks like?
Right, which may be that, which in which case I would have to conclude that the FISA court, these 11 intrepid judges, are a rubber stamp.
Well, they
probably assumed, you know, Andy McCarthy wrote a very interesting thing on at National Review, where a kind of mea culpa, where he said, you know, for months I told everyone this could not possibly happen. Because there are layers upon layers of oversight within the system, inside the FBI, between the FBI and the DOJ, between the DOJ and the FISA court, and it's not possible that they would take this crummy, ridiculous dossier and use that to get a FISA warrant, but they did. So, from my point of view, the question is, we need to work backwards then and say, this is what happened. It's clear what happened on the basis of the, pretty clear, almost, I'm 99% sure on the basis of the redacted FISA warrant that we saw, that this is what happened. So then we have to start asking questions. We have to ask the judges, why did this? How come? I don't know who they are. One of the problems with the system is that it is so opaque.
All right. So let's go to layer number two. Why, assuming you're right, assuming the entire investigation is born in original sin, a lot of investigations are born in original sin. A tip comes in, it's bad. You investigate a bad tip, but boy, it turns out the target of the investigation is guilty of something else, and so you start investigating this thing, and gosh, it sure looks like Paul Manafort was doing $75 million of money laundering. It sure looks like Mike Flynn and George Papadopoulos didn't tell the truth when they were interviewed. At least they pled guilty to that. It sure looks like they've produced evidence that the Russians hacked, a number of people associated with the GRU were involved in a serious hacking operation, and a different group of people were involved in a major social media operation. Carter Page has not been charged. He has not been, indicted. He's a free man. I guess my question is, let's assume you are correct and the whole thing was born in original sin, and Carter Page is a terrible civil liberties victim. And Carter Page, if you're listening, I do not believe that. But if it's true,
How do you not believe that?
What's that?
How do you not believe that?
Because I believe the FISA application is compelling on its own terms, and I don't think there's anything wrong with the FBI getting information from Chris Steele.
What about leaking that information to the press?
So there is absolutely something wrong with leaking that information.
And the FBI did that.
So that I do not believe.
They did.
I believe that information came from The Hill, but
no, we know now. We know now the Isikoff article, the Isikoff article on which the FBI used as part of its FISA application, which is ridiculous in and of itself. It comes from Steele. So you have a guy, the FBI used Steele as a cutout. Steele was providing information to the FBI and then simultaneously providing information to the press. Not just he's providing the same information to the press.
Well, that
combined with the validation that he has special knowledge of the investigation of the FBI and they're looking into it. So he validated his own BS in the eyes of the press through his connection with the FBI.
Okay, so first of all, there's no question that Steele was in touch with the press. There's also no question that Chris Steele is allowed to be in touch with the press. But my point is, even if
Can I stop you there?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Chris Steele is not an FBI agent. He's not an employee of the FBI.
No,
he is allowed to provide information to the FBI.
If you are an FBI agent, let's say Peter Strzok, and you bring, I don't know who exactly handled Steele, but let's assume it's Strzok for the sake of discussion. And you bring Steele in and you take his information and you say, this is very interesting information. And we're looking into it actively. We think it is really serious, and maybe even we're corroborating it with other information that we have. And Chris Steele then goes to the press and says, here's information that I gave to the FBI, and they have told me that they have an investigation into Carter Page, and they're taking this all very seriously, and they have their own independent information that's corroborated. Then that's a huge foul.
Okay, right there. So
he should be burned to you immediately.
Well, hang on a second.
But they kept the relationship with him after that.
Hang on a second. First of all, I don't know that that's what happened, and I don't necessarily believe that that's what happened. But secondly,
we do know that that's what happened.
A cooperating witness can be asked by law enforcement not to talk to the press. But, you know, I, for one, suspect that Don McGahn, who the White House counsel, who is a cooperating witness, has also been talking to the press. Cooperating witnesses, you know, talk to the press all the time. By the way, most people who have cooperated with these investigations have left and quickly picked up the phone and called Maggie Haberman. That seems to be the standard operating procedure of everybody who gets interviewed. You leave the Mueller interview room and you have Maggie's speed dial on your phone. So you call her on the way out. I'm not saying that that's an attractive behavior, but there's no rule that says that you are obliged to, he is not a law enforcement personnel.
Which is exactly why.
In fact,
is exactly why the FBI used him, so that they could leak this information to the press during a campaign with the intention of influencing the campaign and stay one step removed from it so that they couldn't be accused of intervening in domestic politics.
Okay, so chalk that up to a point of disagreement between us.
I want to add one more fact to this. We're going to delve into the weeds here. If you go back and look at the Isikoff article, you'll see that what Steele told to the press, to Isikoff about the FBI, was validated by an FBI, or I can't remember if it said how Isikoff identified the validator, but it was validated by somebody on the Hill, but also by somebody from within the DOJ.
All right. Let us agree that to the extent that the FBI leaked anything, or that the Justice Department leaked anything about the investigation, about an active counterintelligence matter, I will stipulate that is wrong, that is unacceptable.
But let's be clear about what they did. Because this is not a normal leak. This isn't McGahn coming out of a conversation with Mueller and going to Maggie Haberman, because there's the dossier, and Steele is simultaneously sharing the dossier with the FBI and the press, and then acting as the validator to the press of the dossier by saying that the government is taking it seriously and through its own sources of information has validated it. And then whoever is, and then presumably Fusion GPS is Glenn Simpson, is taking people like Isikoff by the hand and saying, oh, here's the phone number of somebody in the DOJ who will validate everything that we just told you.
Okay.
So that's not a leak.
So
that's an information operation.
All right. So number one, to the extent that anything like that happened, and it is more than sources giving information to the government and talking about it to the press, to the extent that the government orchestrated something like that, that's very wrong. Other than you sitting here announcing it, I don't know that's to have happened, and I actually don't believe that to have happened, but I agree with you.
We can just ask Isikoff, right? But of course, Isikoff has an interest in not saying that Glenn Simpson dictated his article for him.
No, look, Glenn Simpson and Mike Isikoff's relationship with each other does not implicate the FBI or the Justice Department at all. To the extent that you're alleging that there's an impropriety on the law enforcement or counterintelligence side, it's governmental involvement in those. And, you know, I want to come back to my question, which is, all right, assume it's all born in original sin. So what? At this point, like, why is that not, you know, there was an impropriety, but there's an investigation arose, and the investigation found some serious stuff.
First of all, I guess I would say there is the smallest matter, but I think we should take it seriously, is that the civil rights of Carter Page have been horribly abused. This guy is the equivalent of the dual national in the White House that I mentioned that I worked with. And his life has been changed irrevocably as a result of the activities of the
so number one, I completely agree with that, but I want to go a little further than that.
I have much more to say. I just want to. I'm gonna build to a crescendo. The point where you're gonna say I agree with you, Mike.
Let's agree on the points that we can agree. I do not agree that the affidavit in support of the warrant was defective. I do agree that the leak of it is inexcusable. And I further agree with something you didn't say, that the public disclosure of it, the demands for its release, was a grave injustice to Carter Page. And that was done by your friend Devin Nunes.
No, I mean, that was already well done. I mean, Carter Page had been splashed all over the pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post for a year before Devin Nunes ever asked for that to come out. So if anything, you know, I think what we should do, I won't even express an opinion. I'll just say, let's put it to Carter Page and see if Carter Page is happy with what Devin Nunes has done or not happy. And my guess is he's quite happy.
So I tend to think you're right, that he's probably happy about it. It doesn't make it less of a civil liberties violation.
Well, I think that he feels at least now that he doesn't have to sit and be accused by shadowy inquisitors that he can't really answer.
Fair enough. We have no argument about the underlying leak.
I realize we could go on about this for hours, because I would like to drill down about what was wrong with the FISA application, but let's just put that aside, because
I still want an answer to my underlying question,
which is
assume you're right. Like, there is now a year and a half of subsequent investigation that has produced a bunch of stuff. Why are you so uninterested in the substance of what they find?
So for a variety of reasons. With no order of importance, I'll just start putting them out. Number one, this was a counterintelligence investigation, which miraculously morphed under Mueller into a criminal investigation.
That happens.
A criminal investigation of what? It's a fundamental aspect of our law that you have to have probable cause. You have to say, before you have an investigation of somebody, you have to say, what is the crime that we believe has been committed that we are investigating? And that's important for anyone, for any American citizen, but it's especially important in matters related to the presidency and elections. Because if you don't have that, if you don't have a clear definition of what a special counsel is investigating, then it becomes, you show me the man and I'll show you the crime. And that's what the Mueller investigation is. Mueller is a pickup truck, is a semi-trailer just running through Trump world and picking up crimes here and there with no clear direction about what it is that he's investigating. Do you know? You tell me, what is the crime that Mueller is supposedly investigating? When he has his conversations with Rod Rosenstein saying, okay, here's your mandate. What's his mandate?
Okay, so I think the answer to that is actually at this point fairly clear. Number one, he was assigned a series of crimes, alleged crimes, by Paul Manafort. He investigated and prosecuted those.
When he was first?
Yeah, in the original letter, it lays out the question of whether Russian interference in the election and any coordination on the part of any campaign with that, any efforts to obstruct the investigation.
Can I stop you right
and
there?
And let me just finish. And then Mueller sought a supplemental letter and got from Rod Rosenstein a supplemental letter that says, and all the stuff that's currently under investigation involving Paul Manafort.
All right. So Paul Manafort's crimes, I have no reason to believe that those are not that those are not crimes.
Okay, so hang on. That's big.
No, it's not big.
No, let's pause over that for a moment.
No, because I want to get to the heart of things. Pause. For you, I'll pause. So I want to get back.
So we're conceding the legitimacy of the Mueller investigation to the extent that it's focused on Paul Manafort.
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought you were doing that.
No. I'm trying to say that Paul Manafort committed crimes.
I see, but you're not. But you don't concede the legitimacy of the prosecution of those crimes.
Exactly.
Okay. Why not?
It is the equivalent of putting the cocaine in somebody's drawer and then discovering that they cheated on their taxes or something. It all goes back to the issue of probable cause and unlawful search and seizure. So let me give you a hypothetical. If Donald Trump had somehow by hook or by crook gotten Jeff Sessions, let's imagine that he didn't recuse himself and Jeff Sessions stood up a special counsel to investigate Uranium One and the Clintons. Do you for a second think that special counsel couldn't come up with all kinds of crimes in Clinton world?
So that happened.
The two other big examples that you give is that
That exact thing happened in Clinton world. It was called the Ken Starr investigation.
By the way, I
never opposed it.
I did.
We discussed this last time.
I found it outrageous. Now, I was a Democrat at the time.
We're actually both being consistent.
I can claim consistency, but I honestly I ask myself this all the time. I don't have an answer. I was a Democrat back then, so my political
preferences aligned both times.
Both times with my morality. So I'm not going to stand here and say that I'm the paragon of morality and consistency. But lucky for me, on this particular issue.
Okay, but let me ask you something, because the standard for opening an investigation and the standard for a search warrant are not the same. The Fourth Amendment.
I'm using it as a metaphor, but I think it's an important metaphor. It's not just a metaphor because there's this issue of especially with special counsels, there's a real constitutional hazard here that these guys can start because they're not under anyone's authority.
So any evidence that Bob Mueller's done that? Because I look at Bob Mueller and I say, everything that is not about Russian intervention in the 2016 campaign, Trump associated coordination with, collusion with, whatever word you want to use, and Paul Manafort, he has gotten rid of. He's simply referred to, in the case of Michael Cohen stuff, the Southern District of New York, in the case of even Maria Butina, who is, you know, that is Russian involvement in the NRA, but it's not the 2016 election. He's tossed it to the National Security Division. What's the evidence of mission creep on the part of Bob Mueller?
First of all, I don't know what his mission is. I was going to stop you before when you said Russian collusion, Russian intervention in the election, and possible coordination with U.S. persons. So there's a crime, right? A crime of treason, or I don't know what the crime is. You can't just give such an open-ended mandate to a special counsel and say, go to it. You can investigate any American, including Donald Trump. And you know, go, you know, fill your boots, as the British say. Fill your boots, Bob, and go do whatever you want. There has to be an actual definition of a crime based on probable cause. And not Rod Rosenstein, not Bob Mueller has ever explained what that might be. Or, and very important, what is the basis for their belief in probable cause? Because I say, you disagree with me, I believe, it's the dossier.
Okay, so let's I do disagree with you, but let's leave that aside. Back when we talked last time, you were pretty emphatic that it was fine to fire, it was attractive to fire Rod Rosenstein, good idea to get rid of Bob Mueller. You sound pretty hardened in that view at this point.
Totally.
All right. So if you were whispering in President Trump's ear, what would you advise him to do now with respect to the senior echelons of the Justice Department, the investigation, and the FBI?
Well, I think we touched on this last time. The problem is that's a political question as much as a legal question or a moral one. Because we have the midterm elections coming up, and so let's talk about scenarios. If the Republicans hold the House, I would hope that the president would dismiss Rosenstein and Mueller shortly thereafter.
And how do you feel about Sessions? Do you share the president's anger at Sessions for recusing himself?
I think that Sessions was taken advantage of.
By whom?
I would assume by Sally Yates and Rod Rosenstein and
Sally Yates?
Because Sally Yates was, you remember, Sally Yates is the proponent of the Logan Act. She was
removed before Sessions ever showed up.
But was she removed before Sessions showed up?
Yeah, because she
right.
Within the first week or so of the Trump administration, she refused to defend the travel ban and was dismissed.
And Sessions hadn't even taken office yet.
Correct.
Okay. So I've got that wrong in the direct sense. But my point is, you know, in the sense of the chronology, but the movement to force Sessions to recuse himself began during the transition. The call that he cannot have possibly, because he hasn't taken office yet, but he's already been appointed, and the idea that he can't possibly have anything to do with this investigation, that begins in Congress early. And Sally Yates is there as a cheerleader to that effort by pushing behind the scenes the notion of the Logan Act violation by Mike Flynn. All of this creating this great sense. If you remember back then, during the time of the transition, there was this tremendous sense in this town, and in the press especially, that there had been some incredible collusion between Trump and Putin, and that the DOJ, we had to wall off the DOJ from the corrupt Trump administration so that this could be investigated. And that call began with Sally Yates, with the DOJ. And I think now that we know all of the corruption that went on there, all of this was so that they could protect themselves from finding out what they had actually done during the campaign. So I think that he was, I think that he was manipulated.
So is there any aspect of the president's conduct toward the Justice Department and the FBI that gives you trouble?
Yeah, sure. I think a lot of his statements are counterproductive.
How so?
I think, well, when he said, I don't have the exact statement at my fingertips, but
categories.
He tweeted something about Sessions has, you know, is letting the Justice Department investigate these Republican congressmen before the midterm and so on. And that plays right in the hands of his enemies. You know, he's the president. He can get information from the DOJ and from the FBI about anything he wants. So there are ways in which he could put out much more measured statements that were vetted by his team that made the case that he has, that his campaign, the members of his campaign have been treated unjustly by the DOJ. And he hasn't done that. I can't explain why.
You worked in the White House under George W. Bush, who I think it is fair to say would never have engaged with a law enforcement operation in this fashion. Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure what you're talking about. I mean, obviously, they're very different. You know, Trump is a little bit of a loose cannon. There's no doubt about it. This isn't about Trump, though, by the way. This is about the DOJ, the FBI, and the presidency.
I'm trying to understand the contours of what you think it is and isn't acceptable for the president to do. The president has floated the idea of pardoning people, pardoning Manafort, pardoning Flynn, pardoning everybody. How legitimate? I mean, he clearly has the power to do it. That's not the question.
Right.
How legitimate is it for him to use the pardon power aggressively to get rid of the meat of this investigation, which is because it is inconveniencing him?
I think it is totally legitimate for him to do that because I think that the investigation itself is totally illegitimate. And I don't believe that the reason he's doing it is because it's inconveniencing. I don't see it from my point of view. The problem isn't that it's inconveniencing Donald Trump. The problem is that it is a gross violation of the Constitution. And every American should be concerned about this. If it were reversed, and this was a Democratic president who was being treated this way by the DOJ, the press would be going crazy.
Mike, I want to wrap up because we've had enough scotch and time to go on with the rest of the day. But I want to end this round because I hope you'll come back 5 or 6 months from now, and I want to try to each identify something that if it comes out that happens, we will concede that we have to move some ground. So here is mine that I will say, if this happens, I will say, okay, I have to buy the scotch next time. If it emerges that, in fact, the investigation started with Carter Page, not with George Papadopoulos, and that the dossier was in fact the origin story of the whole thing. I don't know that I will say, you know, my God, the whole thing is illegitimate, but I will be deeply shocked and I'll be concerned because I think that's counter to everything, every representation that has been made. And I would be very shocked to learn that your world is right about that. And so my question is, what's the reciprocal thing that if you were to learn, you'd have to say, wow, maybe I've drunk some of the Kool-Aid here and, you know, that spawn of Satan, Wittes, may have been more on to certain things than I was.
You know, we're in such different places because in my view, it has already been firmly established that the dossier is what allowed them, A, to launch an investigation into the campaign in general. This wasn't just an investigation of Carter Page. It's an important thing to realize, is that they needed Carter. They could have brought Carter Page in and interviewed him and worked with him like they did in the
Carter
past.
Carter Page wasn't even still part of the campaign at the time.
Yeah, but all of his contacts allow them to investigate others under the pretext of investigating Carter Page. So the Carter Page FISA warrant is the door that allows them to go into the Trump administration, into the Trump campaign in general.
So it's also the
administrative step, the legal step necessary to validate the dossier in the eyes of the press who have seen it all, right? It's all been distributed to them.
What would you have to learn?
I'd have to learn that there was actually collusion between Putin and Trump.
Between Putin and Trump, or between Putin and people in Trump's orbit? So what if, like, tomorrow — it won't happen tomorrow because it's a
no, it has to be Putin and Trump.
So it's not Roger Stone isn't good enough.
No, it has to — well, if you could show that Roger Stone was acting on direct orders of Donald Trump and in close contact, and you'll never be able to do that.
So the collusion with the kind of circle of people around Trump, not good enough for you?
No way. For all the reasons I said, look, think about all of the press around — let me just give you one issue. When it came out that Papadopoulos had pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI, look at all the press commentary that came out about that. Papadopoulos is wearing a wire. This is Mueller. Mueller used this to get leverage over Papadopoulos. And boy, we're going to find out enormous information about this whole big scandal. At every stage of the way, during the campaign and after, everything that Mueller has done has been used by Trump's opponents, by the press, and by the FBI and the DOJ itself to suggest to the public that there's a bigger story that we haven't quite seen yet. So we're just about there, just around that corner. We're going to learn about the horrible collusion between Trump and Putin. And we never quite get around that corner. This is a horrible injustice to the American people, because it's an attempt to reverse an election. That's what's going on.
So you need, in order to concede that there may be some merit to the other side, you need not merely collusion, but collusion that directly implicates Donald Trump individually.
That is the only thing that justifies a special counsel on this issue. There's no doubt. You cannot argue to me that the existence of the special counsel did not breathe life into the thesis that Trump was under the thumb of Putin. That was a major narrative of our politics for the last 2 years. It's complete BS. I've said it from day one. This is total BS. There may have been people around the margins of Trump who had some kind of connection to Russia or whatever. There are people around the margins of — not just the margins. There are in the Hillary Clinton campaign, there are people with direct connections to the Russians. And that person, of course, is Christopher Steele and Glenn Simpson. Not part of the investigation. Why? So to justify having a special counsel, this Mack truck going through Trump world, there has to be some there. And there is no there.
Mike Duran, 6 months from now, I'm sure by then you will have persuaded me of all of it. And I look forward to having you back.
You promised me that we would end this conversation with you saying I was right.
You're right, Mike. You were right about all of it. I was wrong. I concede error. And
you're a very big man.
Not that my fingers are crossed under the table or anything like that. It's good to see you.
Good to see you. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Mike for a lively discussion and for gamely making the trek over to have it. Please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on whatever podcast distribution service you use and give us a rating. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer this episode was Michaela Fogel. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.